amb la segona jornada de la trobada, de la vintena trobada de Barcelona, que celebrem conjuntament entre la Fundació per la Pau i Justícia i Pau de Barcelona, ja fa 22 anys. I ja sabeu que enguany, ja veu els que veu estar ahir a la primera ponència, ens dediquem a parlar d'un tema que creiem que és d'absoluta actualitat per la crisi que estem atravessant, que és desmuntar el negoci de la guerra. Jo, si em permeteu, faig una brevíssima intervenció perquè crec que complementa bastant el que ahir dèiem de l'oportunitat de fer aquesta trobada sobre el tema de la despesa militar i tot el que representa en el negoci de la guerra, sobretot en la crisi que estem atravessant en Europa, especialment, també en Estats Units, com és una de les causes, jo crec personalment, després ho podem parlar entre tots, ho escoltarem els ponents, de la crisi en què estem atravessant. Jo vull donar només ràpidament algunes referències que avui sabem i que no sabíem fa uns anys enrere. Es diu que una de les causes que van motivar la caiguda de la Unió Soviètica és la despesa militar. S'especula. Avui sabem exactament les xifres. Era un dels millors secrets guardats de la Unió Soviètica, la realitat de la despesa militar. Avui sabem, perquè ja és públic, ja hi ha informes que ho diuen, que entre un 15 i un 17% del seu PIB es dedicava a R&D, a recerca i desenvolupament, entre un 15 i un 17. I entre un 30 i un 33% del total del seu PIB anava a despesa militar. Per tant, sí que podem afirmar que segur, ara ja és segur, sabent aquestes dades, que una de les causes, no l'única, determinants de la caiguda de la Unió Soviètica va ser la despesa militar. I cal preguntar-se si aquell imperi es va desplomar, li passarà el mateix als Estats Units. Ja sabeu que la realitat dels Estats Units també és que té un enorme endeutament i aquest enorme endeutament ve en part per la seva despesa militar. La Frida, que estudia precisament la despesa militar als Estats Units, no sé si farà alguna referència en això, però el fet és que la realitat supera, la realitat supera les mentides del Pentàgon, perquè sabem, i ells ho estudien, que la despesa militar als Estats Units gairebé és el doble del que diu el propi govern o la Casa Blanca. I respecte a Europa, molt ràpidament dir dos pinzellades, perquè ahir es va fer referència a la intervenció de Mayor Zaragoza. Fa pocs dies, la ministra de Defensa espanyola, Carmen Chacón, deia que teníem un problema greu. No ho han dit, però en realitat el Ministeri de Defensa espanyol ha fet suspensió de pagaments. Així, clarament. Perquè el mateix secretari de Defensa, Constantino Méndez, en una intervenció en la Comissió de Defensa del Congrés de Diputats, va dir que Espanya té contraigudes unes deutes de 26.000 milions d'euros, que en el seu dia eren 30.000, i que vol dir que ha pagat només 4.000, però que té en aquest moment acumulades unes deutes amb les indústries militars de 26.000 milions d'euros, dels quals 15.000 són en ajuts, en crèdits, en R&D, sortits del Ministeri d'Indústria, i que no pot fer front a aquest pagament. I que, per tant, demanava al Ministeri d'Hisenda que preparés una operació financera per, diguem així, retrasar els pagaments, perquè no pot fer front a aquests pagaments d'uns projectes militars, que molts de vosaltres els coneixeu, les fragates F-100, els Eurofighters, els blindats Leopard, que van ser iniciats fa 15 anys en l'etapa del Partit Popular en el govern i que després, malgrat ara digui el que digui el secretari de Defensa dient que són uns projectes inútils perquè estan dissenyats per un tipus de conflictes en els quals Espanya no entrarà mai, però el fet és que en els governs del PSOE tampoc han anul·lat cap d'aquests projectes i el deute el tenim a sobre la taula. I dic això perquè una de les causes de la caiguda de Grècia, i suposo que ja ho heu llegit en la premsa, també ha estat la despesa militar. Grècia és un país molt endeutat, que també feia trampes en la seva comptabilitat pública, com ha fet Espanya, i no comptabilitzava bona part de la seva despesa militar. La pròpia Eurostat de la Unió Europea ho ha reconegut i s'han trobat diguem així, inversions en armes que no estaven comptabilitzades i ha estat sancionada. I quan el govern de Grècia, de Papandreou, ha posat sobre la taula que tenia que reduir la despesa militar, que podien ser, bueno, enguany ja l'ha reduït en 1.000 milions d'euros, quan ha dit que tindria que suspendre alguns projectes militars, la pròpia Alemanya i la pròpia França, que tenen contractes amb Grècia per vendre-li projectes militars per valor de 3.600 milions d'euros, han dit: suspèn el que vulguis, però no ens suspenguis els nostres contractes militars, perquè si no, no rebràs l'ajuda per reflotar la teva economia. Per tant, a sobre la taula està el tema de la despesa militar, oportunitat d'aquestes jornades no podia ser millor, perquè, sens dubte, si reduïm la despesa militar, podríem fer front a moltes de les necessitats socials que en aquest moment estan amenaçades en el nostre estat i en molts estats europeus. Feta aquesta breu i brevíssima intervenció, passo la paraula als ponents, que són els que, d'alguna manera, són els protagonistes d'aquesta tarda. Ja sabeu que aquesta trobada coincideix amb un seminari que es fa a Barcelona en el que participa el War Resisters International, aquesta centenària entitat de resistents a la guerra, i entre els quals la Frida és la part americana d'aquest grup, però també del European New War Against Arms Trade. I que, per tant, en aquesta sala tenim una quarantena de persones del Moviment per la Pau, no solament europeu, sinó mundial, als quals agraïm molt que hagin escollit Barcelona per fer aquesta trobada i hagin enriquit precisament aquesta trobada amb la seva presència, i que els tenim a tres d'ells en aquesta taula. Intervendran per l'ordre que ara els anunciaré, i que en primer lloc parlarà la Frida Berrigan, que és membre de la World Resisters League d'Estats Units. I Frida Berrigan és, com la resta, uns competents militants de la causa pacifista. I dic militants en el sentit més valoratiu de la paraula. Perquè Frida ha estat investigadora en temes de comerç d'armes, de seguretat nacional, ha treballat a la Universitat de New School de New York, és columnista en diferents diaris, per tant, creadora d'opinió a favor en contra de la despesa militar, i ha participat en múltiples mobilitzacions com a militant d'accions no violentes contra les guerres d'Iraq i Afganistan. Després tenim Alexis Rendon. Ella és una integrant d'un diari llibertari, es diu El Libertario, de Venezuela. És, a més de, per tant, periodista, és una activista que treballa en l'organització Provea de Drets Humans de Venezuela. Només dir-vos que Provea és una organització de drets humans independent. I quan dic independent, independent de l'Estat de Venezuela, per tant, que té tota la credibilitat reconeguda per organitzacions de drets humans internacionals per fer un bon anàlisi de la situació que viu política a Venezuela. I, per últim, tenim també la sort de tenir amb nosaltres a Rob Thompson. Rob Thompson és fundador, un antic militant de la causa pacifista de Sud-àfrica, és de l'organització Cipher Campaign, i ha treballat en accions no violentes precisament durant l'etapa de l'apartheid, contra l'apartheid del règim racista de Sud-àfrica. Té també una llarga trajectòria en temes de comerç d'armes i està vinculat a la campanya de Iansa per el control de les armes curtes. Res més, i els hi passo la paraula a ells per aquest ordre. En primer, Frida.
Thank you. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to speak in English. So if you need translation, you put the thing on now. I would love to speak in Spanish, but it would be very rudimentary, my presentation, should I have to speak in Spanish. It's a real pleasure to be here, an honor to be able to participate both in this panel and be part of the weekend seminar. So I'm very happy to be here and very happy to see so many people out to talk about these issues. I think in the U.S. most of the time we would have, 20 people at a seminar like this. So Thank you all for coming. I've been asked to talk about who the war profiteers are in the United States, how these corporations benefit from war and preparations for war, and I will try and do that, but I wanted to start a little differently this evening. You know, as I was thinking about preparing for this talk, you know, it's very easy for all of us, I think, to focus on everything that's wrong, right? All of the bad stuff that's happening, how strong they are, and how comparatively sort of small and weak we are. But that picture, while sort of motivating in its way, and certainly true in many ways, gives short shrift to the people who are organizing and struggling and even occasionally winning in all of the struggles that we're engaged with. And it occurred to me as well that the focus of our weekend is war profiteers and peace movement responses. So I wanted to start this evening with the peace movement responses, especially because I'm concerned about this image of the United States that you probably get on your televisions, of that we all just sit around and watch the Jersey Shore and Britney Spears and don't do anything, but some of us do that. But so I wanted to give a couple snapshots, just because right now is a particularly exciting and dynamic time, certainly all over the world, but even in the United States. Even in the United States, there is dynamism and activism right now. So maybe just a couple snapshots, and these are just a few that I could think of coming here. So last week in Washington, D.C., there was a small group of people outside of a fancy hotel, very, you know, $300 a night hotel. And they were there because representatives from each of the major companies in the United States that manufactures weapons were gathered for a meeting. And they do this every year. It's called the Air Force Association meeting. And people from the Pentagon and the Air Force and then the weapons contractors all come. They stay in the fancy hotel. They meet each other and they eat expensive meals and they go to meetings together. They eat $16 muffins. And they talk about how hard their lives are, right, and how difficult business is in this challenging economic environment. So there was even a banquet where everybody paid $330 for a plate of food that was co-sponsored by Lockheed Martin, the largest weapons manufacturer in the United States. So outside there was this small group of people, and they were there for each of the days of the conference. They tried repeatedly to go inside to talk to the people from the Air Force and the military industry. There was a big bunch of police out there keeping them away. They displayed signs and they read repeatedly from this statement. We cannot let the arms merchants who are displaying the latest killing technology and weapons to conduct their gala banquet without protest. We seek to give voice to the victims who have suffered and died in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and elsewhere as a direct result of U.S. war making. Weapons like the drone Predator, the Reaper bombing planes produced by the arms contractors who are inside at this gala event. So that was just one snapshot there. Another snapshot is from New York City, and perhaps this is one that more people know about, the occupation of Wall Street that is ongoing. And in the heart of soulless capitalism, there at the bottom of New York City, thousands have come to participate in and witness a new kind of democracy. This past week, they slept on the sidewalk, they marched, they protested, they hosted a constant parade of luminaries and famous people, you know, Susan Sarandon, Michael Moore, the rapper Immortal Technique, Cornel West, Lupe Fiasco, hopefully some of these names are familiar to you, all came to kind of be a part of this dynamic form of protest, very much inspired by Egypt, by Greece, by Spain, by London, by all of these large mobilizations that are happening in your countries. And they said, Occupy Wall Street is a leaderless resistance movement with people of many colors, genders, and political persuasions. The one thing we all have in common is that we are the 99% that will no longer tolerate the greed and corruption of the 1%. And this has grown and bloomed and inspired other cities. So now there's Occupy Boston, Occupy Denver, Occupy, you know, tens and tens, hopefully hundreds of other cities as it goes on. It's my personal hope that this activism this week, just last week, will finally kill the, you know, there's this old trope for myth in the United States that young people are disengaged, that they don't care about anything, that back in the 60s, all the young people were really on the front lines, and today's kids are just kind of apathetic. And I think hopefully this week of activism will kill that myth, will kill that perception, will show that young people really are so radical and so creative and so far ahead of older generations in these ways. Another snapshot, this weekend, right now, begins a week of action against nuclear weapons, against the militarization of space. And this is a global week of action involving thousands and thousands of people around the world, and it's organized out of this little tiny town in Bath, in Maine, you know, way up in the northeast of the United States. And this little tiny town is the home of a huge weapons contractor, Northrop Grumman, which makes the Aegis destroyer, this enormous boat that can carry nuclear weapons, that can carry conventional weapons. And I like thinking about this little group. They have this terrible long name, the Global Network Against the Militarization and Nuclear Weapons in Space, right? There's no way to make an acronym out of that title. But I think about them like out of a script of a science fiction film, right? This battle between the powers that have colonized the heavens, right? That have put all of these weapons up into space, and colonized space for military domination, and then these tiny little communities all over the world that want to see those billions of dollars and all of that brilliance, right? Like all these scientific engineering minds that are conceiving of these weapons want to see all of that harnessed for peace instead of for war making. So that's going on, and then all the way on the other side of the country in the Southwest, there's hundreds of people gathering this weekend for the Catholic Worker National Gathering. And there they are in Las Vegas, Nevada, right? Where all the casinos are, this sort of artificial city in the middle of the desert. And there are the acolytes of Dorothy Day and Peter Morin, people who believe in doing the works of mercy, in personalism, in adhering to a radical vision that wants to redistribute wealth, take it out of the hands of the bosses, take power out of the hands of bishops and popes and experts and intellectuals, and to put all of that into the hands of the poor, in the hands of the people. And there they are in this city that best exemplifies my country's quest for mindless entertainment, for wealth without labor, for rapacious consumption of resources, and there they are sort of infiltrating this false city. This weekend they'll meet and they'll pray, they'll share and resist, and at the end of the weekend they'll go to the Nevada test site, right, this place where thousands of nuclear weapons were tested, this indigenous sacred land that was taken over by the United States military for the purpose of testing nuclear weapons, you know, many of them will occupy that land at the invitation of the indigenous communities, the Shoshone people who, you know, still consider it theirs, right? And of course, not at the invitation of the Department of Defense that, you know, wants them very much to stay out of that territory. Another little snapshot is in Minneapolis, right in the middle of the country, or the upper middle of the country. A small group of activists will come together this weekend, and they'll celebrate the 142nd birthday of Mahatma Gandhi, right? And they'll meet, and they'll share, and they'll discuss what happens next, right? And they're asking that question because for the last 17 years, they've been vigiling every week, every single week, in the cold, in the hot, vigiling at this weapons manufacturer called Alliant Tech Systems. Alliant used to be Honeywell. During the Vietnam War, they made cluster bombs, they made landmines. Now they're called something different. They're called Alliant Tech Systems. They changed their name because Honeywell became too associated with the Vietnam War, too associated with the death of civilians and the maiming of children and landmines. So they changed their name, they changed their corporate image, became Alliant Tech Systems, but they still build cluster munitions both for the United States and for export. And they are trying very hard to make humane cluster weapons, right? Humane cluster weapons. These would be weapons that would have an off switch or would somehow not turn into landmines, which cluster weapons essentially do. And we can talk more about that during discussion if people are interested. But Alliant Tech Systems is moving to Washington, D.C. They're closing up their factory in Minneapolis. They're moving to Washington to be closer to their customers, right? To be closer to the center of U.S. power, of military power there. So there's this small group of activists. They're looking for a new place to protest, if anybody has any ideas. They're very committed, and they're out there even when it's, 20 degrees below zero. So that's happening in another place. Coming full circle, coming back to Washington, D.C., just as, this Occupy Wall Street group is kind of growing and having more momentum, there's a group that's been planning an occupation in Washington, right? And they've been planning it for the 10th anniversary of the beginning of the war in Afghanistan, which will be next weekend, October 7th, will mark 10 years since the United States launched its onslaught of Afghanistan. So they're bringing people from all over the country, perhaps all over the world, we hope, and asking people to pledge. And this is the pledge. I pledge that if any U.S. troops and contractors or mercenaries remain in Afghanistan on Thursday, October 6th, the day before the 10 years, as that criminal occupation goes into its 11th year, I will commit to being in Freedom Plaza, and there really is a Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C., with the intention of making it our Tahrir Square, where we will nonviolently resist the corporate machine to demand that our resources are invested in human need and environmental protection instead of war and exploitation. We can do this together. We are the beginning. So that's kind of the next thing that's going to happen when I get back to the States. So I share these different snapshots from different parts of the country. Some are very small, some are larger, some are sort of regular, some are, these single episodes. Just to kind of show the dynamism of my own peace movement, to remind myself of the dynamism of my peace movement, and to highlight what I think are very creative and diverse peace movement responses to a nation, to my nation, where it seems the only successful and profitable export is war, right? And to demonstrate to all of you and to myself, to remind myself that despite the bleak outlook, despite the dark times, the United States is a nation up in arms, a nation that's struggling and resisting and organizing. So switching gears now to look at what the costs of U.S. war are and who profits from U.S. war, I think I saw quite a few people picking up this resource from the War Resisters League, this pie chart, and we do this every year And it shows, U.S. military spending, and calls the lie, right, that what the Obama administration will talk about when they talk about military spending is just this one part here, this one little piece of the graph, right, which represents the base budget of the Pentagon, of the Department of Defense, and the budget for what we call under the Obama administration overseas contingency operations, During the Bush administration, we called it the Global War on Terror, or GWAT. I think that was a little bit more honest description than something that sounds so banal and non-threatening, overseas contingency operations. But anyway, I haven't been keeping very good track of time, so I hope I'm okay on time. But the fiscal year, the new fiscal year for the United States starts on October 1st. So this is the fiscal year 2012. The base budget for the Pentagon, for the Department of Defense, is about $550 billion, right? And then, as you can see from the chart, if you picked up a copy of it, there's this money to continue the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, or the winding down, perhaps, of the war in Iraq and the continuation of the war in Afghanistan. So $117 billion for those two military operations. And then, in addition to that, we also have spending on nuclear weapons. We can talk more about this in discussion if people are interested. But this year, 2012, the United States will spend $18 billion on the research and development of nuclear weapons. And that's more than double what we spent last year. And there's a whole story there that I can get into if people are interested. But I'll just briefly say that we've doubled nuclear weapons research and development spending under a president who stood in Prague and committed to nuclear disarmament, right? Committed to a world free of the threat of nuclear weapons. So this isn't a holdover from the Bush administration. This is the Obama administration, accelerating this significantly. And then there's money for homeland security. There's money for other aspects of militarism that's also in there. You add all of that together, and you get, this red area, $869 billion that the United States will spend in 1 year on defense, on the military. And then the War Resisters League, if you are looking at the pie chart, also counts the ongoing costs of paying for past wars as part of current military spending. So even as the United States faces an economic crisis similar to many other countries, there has been an unwillingness, a complete unwillingness to significantly lower the U.S. military budget. It's worth pointing out that in 2000, a decade ago, the military budget was roughly half what it is today. So we've seen a huge increase in military spending. Of course, the wars account for some of that, but most of that is just increasing of spending because we can spend more. There's been a five-year freeze on all sorts of other spending, a five-year freeze, no increases in education or in health and human services. Everything's frozen because of the budget crisis. Military spending continues to go up. Now, that might be changing soon. It's now on the table in a renewed way that we could have to cut the U.S. military budget. And we can talk about more that more in the discussion if people are interested in these proposals to radically trim, if you can radically trim something. I don't know if you can, but to cut in a significant way, more than just around the margins, cut the U.S. military budget. So who benefits from this? Who receives all of this money that U.S. taxpayers of today and tomorrow and 100 years ago, 100 years from now, as we rack up this enormous debt, who benefits from all of this? And you can really say that, you know, five companies benefit. Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, Raytheon, General Dynamics. Just five companies benefit from this. I mean, obviously, there are hundreds of companies that are part of the military-industrial complex, right? But these five, you know, together control 50, 60% of the contracts that the Pentagon gives out on an annual basis. So in 2010, the last year we have, you know, good, solid data for, Lockheed Martin took in $16 billion worth of contracts. Northrop Grumman, 11, Boeing, 10, Raytheon, 6, General Dynamics, 5, right? Just to go through them very quickly. And these companies, these handful of companies, do everything, right? They all have, you know, they have some specialties or specializations, right? Northrop Grumman builds ships and Raytheon builds planes, but Boeing also builds planes and Raytheon also builds some helicopters. And so there's a lot of collaboration, very little true competition amongst these companies, very much collaboration amongst them on big deals. So they outfit and supply the military as it fights in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan, elsewhere where there are troops or U.S. interests. They develop the technology to monitor and militarize our borders. They make the satellites that circle the heavens. They make the nuclear submarines and the aircraft carriers that patrol our seas. They're responsible for the nuclear missile silos that are throughout our Midwest region. And they are constantly imagining new and more sophisticated weapons every day. Just to talk about these five companies, between 2001 and 2010, their profits quadrupled, if I'm doing the math right, from about $6 billion in 2001, you know, collectively, to more than $24 billion. So that's maybe they thriced. $24 billion in 2010. They're also paying themselves quite well. Unlike in some other countries, all of these corporations are completely private companies, and the United States military is their customer, right? And foreign militaries are their customers, but they are private. Their chief executives are paid millions of dollars a year, literally. $8, $10, $12 million a year to the men, and it's all men, the men who run these companies. And they have a very close relationship with members of Congress. They pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to the campaign, in campaign contributions to members of Congress, and ensure that those members of Congress vote in their interests year after year. So I'll just finish up by, you know, mentioning again the pie chart, and please take a copy or a few copies if you find it helpful. Also, I put out on the table this this cute little cardlet. Isn't this cute? It's a little dated now, but the War Resisters League put it out, and it sort of outlines who are all of the war profiteers. So the numbers are, you know, a couple years old, but the reality is the same. So I'll just conclude by saying, you know, in the face of this, we need to continue, right? We need to not get overwhelmed. We need to not get exhausted by how big these corporations are. We need to find their weaknesses, and they have them. Organize together, strategize together, and continue to do this work together. So I'm happy to be part of it with all of you. Thank you.
A mí fue una responsabilidad muy grande porque yo soy de Venezuela y medianamente puedo entender lo que pasa en el país. Imagínense, en realidades tan complejas, plurales, como América Latina en general. Sin embargo, yo voy a tratar de hacer algo bastante Vale. Bastante, gracias. Bastante digerible para todos en términos de cifras, sin entrar en algunas especificaciones que podrían comprometer lo que yo considero es algo que también cada uno de los países y estados tiene que comenzar a decir, ¿no? Entonces, desde mi perspectiva, desde el análisis que nosotros venimos haciendo en tema de quiénes compran, quiénes venden, quiénes ganan y se benefician de la guerra, está esta presentación. Hay ya un estudio bastante importante que está disponible para ustedes, que lo hizo la Fundación Perla Pau acerca de América Latina. Es muy bueno, es un referente para nosotros también y les invito a que lo lean, a que lo tengan y a que lo discutan. Es muy bueno. Yo lo que quería decir con relación a esto es que ciertamente ahí hay todo el estudio de lo que significa Estados Unidos y los gastos en los presupuestos. Y la intervención de Estados Unidos a través de diferentes métodos y de diferentes prácticas en lo que es la vida y la tranquilidad de los pueblos del continente, ¿no? Y yo no quiero andar en eso, creo que es bastante conocido lo del Comando Sur, lo del Plan Puebla-Panamá, el Plan Colombia, es algo que la mayoría de los que estamos acá manejamos y que en este texto pueden conseguir muy bien también. Yo lo que deseaba era conversar un poco acerca de que mi trabajo no se basa tanto en el PIB, porque tenemos algunas cosas como que, por ejemplo, en Venezuela se hacen unos presupuestos en gastos militares, pero el presupuesto consta de algunas otras cosas que desconocemos porque es secreto de Estado, porque es información que no se puede dar. Entonces, realmente los gastos, aparte de lo que aparece en el presupuesto, es desconocido y es muy grande. Sí, nosotros tenemos en el gasto del presupuesto el cuarto puesto después de educación y después de Ministerio de Interior y Justicia y después de salud está el presupuesto de defensa. Es el cuarto lugar, es aproximadamente 18 veces más grande que el presupuesto para el Ministerio de la Mujer y 23 veces más grande que el de pueblos indígenas. Entonces, más o menos una cifra importante. Yo voy a dar algunos datos con relación a lo que está sucediendo en América Latina y para entender un poco y dar también otra versión con relación a lo que es el tema de Estados Unidos, quería mostrarle una comparación bastante breve y rápida sobre lo que ha sido la venta y la compra de armas en los últimos 30 años. Tenemos que, según las cifras del CIPRI, desde 1980 hasta el 2010, en los últimos 30 años, América Latina ha comprado en armamento 45.085.000 de dólares estadounidenses, ¿no? Estos son datos del CIPRI. Tenemos que el país que más ha vendido a América Latina es Estados Unidos, con 8.891. La URSS, estoy hablando de hace 30 años, una comparación en 30 años, y son 6.350, estamos hablando de millones de dólares americanos, y luego estaría Alemania con 5.745. Los 20 países que más comercian armas con las naciones latinoamericanas están desde abajo hasta arriba, incluyendo también Chile, que también produce algunas cosas. Esta es más o menos la perspectiva de lo que ha sucedido en estos 30 años. Pero lo que yo quería mostrar es que si sumamos los montos de la URSS con lo que es ahora la Federación Rusa, tenemos que quienes más armas han vendido a América Latina es precisamente la Federación Rusa. Por encima de Estados Unidos, sumando 9.272 millones de dólares. En los 80 se gastaron aproximadamente, o Latinoamérica en general gastó 25.583 millones de dólares, en los 90 se redujo y en el 2000 al 2010 hubo un aumento. Entendemos que en los 80 este gasto también se debe mucho a los propios conflictos que habían en América Latina, sobre todo en países de Centroamérica. Aquí lo que quería mostrarles es más que todos los 5 primeros países que han comprado armas a Estados Unidos en estos 30 años. Primero está Colombia, todos sabemos el Plan Colombia, toda la intervención que tiene Estados Unidos allí, las bases, todo el interés que Estados Unidos tiene en Colombia, disculpen. El segundo es México, ahí están las cifras. El tercero es Argentina, el cuarto es Venezuela y el quinto es Chile. y ahí está una tabla con los primeros, con los 19 países. Las ventas de armas a Rusia que tenemos Cuba fue el primer comprador con 4.556, luego está Venezuela, Perú, Nicaragua, México y hasta abajo. Los que son más compradores de la región, Chile, sabemos también que Chile es un país que tiene un presupuesto incluso ya definido dentro de la exportación del cobre para gastos militares. Y Venezuela, que ha tenido un aumento progresivo de gasto militar en estos últimos años, no es que antes no lo hiciera, también lo hacía, pero ahora hemos tenido bastantes compras militares con las compras a futuro, es decir, hemos tenido algunos endeudamientos con Rusia para comprar aproximadamente 4.000 millones de dólares en armamento. Argentina, Brasil y Perú. Las tendencias, las últimas tendencias 2000 al 2009, es que Rusia es el mayor vendedor, sigue Estados Unidos, Holanda, Francia, ahí está toda la tabla. Para no abrumarlos con muchas cifras. Estados Unidos, las ventas de 2000 a 2009, Colombia, con el Plan Colombia, con todo el intercambio, con todos los compromisos que han creado entre ambos países, es el que mayor compra tiene esta última década. Le sigue México y luego Argentina. Y Venezuela es la primera que está adquiriendo más armas de 2000 al 2009, con 2.068 millones de dólares, México con 116.000 y 104. Los más compradores de la región, ahí están. Los exportadores latinoamericanos, según CIPRI, en el periodo 1980-2010, Brasil exportó, es decir, lo que se produce dentro de Latinoamérica y se manda tanto a otros países dentro de Latinoamérica como a otras partes del mundo. Brasil exportó armas de 2.522 millones de dólares, comparativamente menos de la mitad del total adquirido a otros países. Es decir, exportó, pero importó más. El país que más compra armamento de Brasil es Irak, por un monto de 561 millones de dólares. El segundo país que más ha adquirido armas con Brasil es Colombia, con un total de 237 millones, y el tercer lugar, Reino Unido. El principal rubro de exportación del país son los aviones de combate y los tanques. Sin embargo, Brasil también es el primer exportador latinoamericano de armas pequeñas y ligeras, 8% del mercado mundial. Y después podemos, si quieren, conversar un poco de lo terrible que está haciendo para los países latinoamericanos las armas en manos de ciudadanos. En Venezuela nosotros tenemos una población aproximada de 28 millones de personas y Amnistía Internacional dice que más o menos entre 8 y 15 millones de armas están en manos de los ciudadanos. Y tenemos un país muy violento donde todos los fines de semana muere muchísima gente víctima de la AMPA y de las armas en los ciudadanos, ¿no? Brasil impulsa el desarrollo de su propia industria por varias razones. Intenta ser aceptada en el Consejo de Seguridad de la ONU, desea ser menos dependiente de proveedores de armas internacionales y crear su propio complejo militar, y su crecimiento macroeconómico, que es evidente que en la región se siente y que se está constituyendo en uno de los grandes industriales de la región. Ya lo era, pero ahora se nota con mucho más fuerza. Las exportaciones de armas españolas, según el CIFRI, España se situó en el 2010 en el noveno puesto dentro de la clasificación global de principales exportadores de armas, descendiendo dos puestos con respecto al 2009. Venezuela compró 213,6 millones de euros relativos a la venta de dos buques de vigilancia costera y munición para buques, así como material antidisturbio. El material antidisturbio son bombas lacrimógenas, son todo lo que se utiliza cuando hay algún tipo de contención de manifestaciones o que pueden ser agresivas, ¿no? Venezuela con 203, y México con 126 millones de euros por la venta de 6 aviones de transporte. Fueron los dos destinos principales de las ventas registradas a lo largo del 2010. Venezuela, junto con Perú, fue el único que recibió material antidisturbios por un importe de 1.6 millones de euros en artificios lacrimógenos y partes y piezas. A Perú se le vendieron bombas de gas por un valor de 0.3 millones. Es un informe de exportaciones españolas de material. Aquí están los datos, según las estadísticas españolas, de exportación de material. Creo que más o menos ustedes deben manejarlo muchísimo mejor que yo. Parte de la información que nosotros manejamos no sale del Estado venezolano, sino que la tenemos a través de la información que publica España. Yo quería hacer un énfasis en esto, porque Venezuela, a través de la Constitución Bolivariana de Venezuela que se aprobó, tiene prohibido el uso de armas tóxicas contra los ciudadanos y las ciudadanas. Sin embargo, es una de las cosas que más está comprando a España. Es decir, España está ayudando al Estado venezolano a violentar su propia Constitución. Y sabemos que las bombas lacrimógenas, las cosas antidisturbios, no son para defendernos de una potencia extranjera. Son para contener problemas internos o críticas internas. Y eso me voy a referir después. Quería hablar un poco de lo que significan los gobiernos de izquierda. Podemos decir que en la América Latina hay dos posturas con relación al militarismo. Una que es la tradicional, la clásica, que podría estar representada en Colombia y en Chile y en el propio México, que tiene que ver con esa posición tradicional de vinculación con los Estados Unidos y de todo lo que ha sido la política militar. Sin embargo, ahora vemos unos cambios con los cambios de gobierno denominados progresistas, que han hecho varios bloques de entendimiento, pero que eso no ha sido un factor para disminuir sus gastos en materia militar. Muy por el contrario, también el tema del imperialismo estadounidense, del intervencionismo, que no es falso, sirve como excusa para seguir gastando grandes cantidades de dinero en armamento. Nosotros tenemos el IRSA, yo quería comentarles esto porque nosotros tenemos la teoría, y es aparte del tema de la intervención estadounidense dentro de lo que es la economía de los países latinoamericanos, que como todos saben es una región rica en materia prima. Y quería hablar un poco del IRSA porque el IRSA es muy parecido a lo que podría decirse es el Pueblo a Panamá más el ALCA más todos los tratados internacionales de comercio, porque es una nueva forma de extractivismo en América del Sur. Esto existe, lo pueden buscar, www.irsa.com. También la CAF está muy involucrada en estos proyectos. Son proyectos que tienen características de todo tipo. Primero, permite la explotación de los recursos naturales, entre ellos los energéticos, cosa que Venezuela no podía participar de manera muy viva dentro del ALCA, porque Venezuela lo que tiene es materia prima, lo que produce es petróleo, gas, minería, y ahora encontramos coltrán para otras cosas. Y este proyecto sí define específicamente la explotación de energía y como parte de los intercambios. Este proyecto es la construcción de carreteras, es la construcción de vías aéreas. Se dice que es para tratar de hacer en América Latina o en Sudamérica una especie de unión europea donde todos podamos viajar, pero en el fondo lo que está es el comercio, en el fondo lo que está también es la creación de nuevas formas de dominación. Y yo lo que quería también es que si se fijan, ahí está Bolivia, no sé si están enterados de lo que sucedió en Bolivia con el TIPNIS, que fue muy fuerte, y si ven, ahí está marcado el territorio boliviano, cómo tienen algunos compromisos para construcción de vías y carreteras para todo lo que va a ser la comercialización de este tratado, que de verdad, mi parte de que yo esté aquí es para tratar de dar voz a quienes no pueden tenerla y decir, ayúdennos a denunciar esto. No es que me crean, es que lo busquen, es que por favor entiendan que esto es muy grave para las comunidades que allí viven, para el medio ambiente, y nadie está hablando de esto. Y parte de lo que está ayudando a que esto suceda y quede callado es que la gente toma posturas por el progresismo o la derecha. En el fondo, los que sufren, los que están siendo expoliados, son los pueblos, independientemente de cuál sea su gobierno. Una de las cosas que yo quería, para no extenderme mucho, es que Venezuela el año que viene va a ser el primer país latinoamericano que va a tener fábricas de Kalashnikov. Nosotros en Venezuela tenemos una militarización creciente, abrumadora, de la sociedad, no solamente porque el presidente sea militar, sino porque hay una estructura de polarización que ayuda a que las críticas todas sean llevadas al campo de la crítica malsana, de decir que no es válido, de decir que es parte del imperialismo, que es parte de una componente contra la soberanía de los pueblos. Y este proyecto dice que es la soberanía de América del Sur y está tratando de crear a través de la UNASUR ejércitos conjuntos para defender los recursos naturales, pero es para la explotación de los recursos naturales en esta nueva forma de capitalismo que se está imponiendo en los países que tienen recursos económicos, sobre todo recursos de materia prima, que es el extractivismo. Raúl Siveche lo habla, extractivismo, después de la fase del liberalismo, está Pablo Dávalos, que habla también del silencio y las complicidades en las nuevas formas de neoliberalismo, y yo les invito también a quizás que puedan ver el libro de Rafael Uzcategui, La revolución como espectáculo, porque habla muchísimo de cómo esto permite que cosas por debajo sucedan sin que nadie reclame para no darle armas al enemigo. Quería invitarlos a que este 7 de octubre, para no extenderme en temas de derechos humanos ni nada de eso, que es lo que yo trabajo, además de esto, Venezuela presenta el EPU, Venezuela es el examen periódico universal ante las Naciones Unidas, este 7 de octubre. Allí diferentes organizaciones sociales independientes hemos presentado nuestros pequeños informes, nuestra visión, nuestras voces de lo que creemos el Estado debe asumir como recomendaciones en pro y beneficio de las y de los venezolanos. No es una crítica proimperialista, no es una crítica para tumbar al gobierno, es una crítica para que el gobierno escuche y haga un cambio en las necesidades de presupuestarias de 4,000 millones de dólares en armas para beneficio de las personas. Yo quería concluir diciendo una frase de Camus que a mí me gusta mucho, yo respeto muchísimo todas las ideologías, yo pertenezco a un periódico que es libertario, no quiero lanzarme a alcaldesa ni a presidenta ni nada, por lo tanto no tengo intereses de toma de poder, mi interés es la gente y por lo tanto Albert Camus decía que nosotros debemos ponernos del lado de quienes padecen la historia, no de quienes la escriben, no las escribamos con bombas, escribámoslos con los derechos humanos, por favor. Gracias.
Is right to focus on war profiteering because this gives us an analysis of who drives war in the 21st century. And this in turn enables us to develop strategies to end war. I'm going to focus firstly on illegal war profiteering in Africa, and then on so-called legal war profiteering in Africa, and then use that as a context to talk about legal war profiteering in South Africa. My own interest and involvement is in South Africa. I can't pretend to be an expert on the rest of Africa. Africa is a big continent. We see gun peddling in Africa during anarchy and civil war, for example, in Somalia, in the Democratic Republic of Congo. We see illegal sales of arms by soldiers, by ex-combatants and returning peacekeepers, as in Mali, Nigeria, Mozambique, Burundi. We see informal gunsmiths, for example, and particularly in Ghana, in Tanzania, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, in Burundi, in Nigeria, and in South Africa. We see the failure of end user certificates. An end user certificate is intended to warrant that arms exported to the signatory country will not be exported again to a third party. These end user certificates are repeatedly being disregarded. False end user certificates are being issued by neighboring states deliberately, for example, Guinea-Bissau and Ivory Coast. Some countries are acting as conduit states, for example, Eritrea for Ukraine and arms from Ukraine to Somalia, or for the movement of arms to conflict zones, for example, between Cote d'Ivoire and Liberia. We have a problem of porous borders. We have a problem of poor control of airspace. And these problems lend themselves to the movements of small arms and light weapons around Africa. We have the problem of theft from dealers, from armories, and from residences, for example, in Nigeria, in Somalia, and in South Africa. We have the problem of smuggling of arms, for example, Nigeria, Guinea-Bissau, Gabon, and Cameroon. We have a problem of blood diamonds. This was particularly rife in Angola, but it subsequently became rife in other countries such as Liberia, Sierra Leone, Ivory Coast, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and the Congolese Republic. We have a problem of oil bunkering, particularly in Nigeria, where oil is exchanged offshore for either for arms direct or for money which soon gets changed into arms. We have bribery and corruption associated with legal war profiteering, as in South Africa. Illegal war profiteering in Africa, in the preceding slides, black faces predominate. But of course, most people in Africa are black. The problem does not arise from their blackness. In the preceding slide also, references are made to individual slides, to individual states. I've made references to various states. They are different. Beware of treating Africa as if it was a homogeneous entity, as if it was a single block. It is not. It's a complex place. And the differences between states are complex. But we need to understand the historical process that has led to the illegal war profiteering, mostly on a small scale, that is happening in that I've been showing in the slides that I've been presenting. The exploitation of Africa by colonialism, by the Cold War, the bulk of arms circulating in Africa are of Russian extraction, Russian origin, dating from the Cold War, and by the current exploitation of Africa by global capitalism and the new Cold War, particularly with China. The problem of global capitalism is that the industrialized states have effectively exported their unemployment to Africa. Capitalism doesn't need labor as much as it needs capital. And in Africa, we have labor. We don't have capital. And labor lands up idle. We have a problem of alienation. Alienation is typical of the capitalist system. People are alienated from the global system. We have the problem of the exploitation of the resources and the environment. We have the involvement of global capitalists in the exploitation of African resources, where the companies are paying the rebels, for example, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, for protection. And these form paramilitary organizations, and they perpetuate them. The challenge to the peace movement is that this is a new line of research. How do we relate these exploitations, different forms of exploitation, to the movement of arms around South Africa? The movement of arms around Africa comes from various sources. It comes from power contests, from gendered institutions, from civil war and anarchy, from drought, famine, and high food prices. But these are the drivers of the illegal movement of illegal war profiteering in South Africa, in Africa. I'd like to turn now to so-called legal war profiteering in Africa. Here, this chart shows Africa's top 10 arms buyers during the period 2000 to 2010. And what I've shown across the top of the slide are the criteria, the European Union criteria for arms sales. So we shouldn't be selling arms to countries with poor human rights records, against which there are arms embargoes, where there are governance problems, where there is conflict, countries that don't implement arms control conventions, where there are development problems. And the red areas show those countries which have these problems, and yet these are the top 10 arms buyers. So, for example, Egypt is showing red on human rights, on governance, on conventions, and on development. Even South Africa shows red on conflict because of our own xenophobic violence in South Africa. So none of these countries should be in receipt of arms from the European Union. This slide shows the criteria. If you look at the previous slide, what I've done is to see which is the worst. Maybe I should use this little. No, I don't have a. So for each of these, you'll see that there is at least one red. Here, you'll see that virtually every country in Africa has at least one red. I've shown the worst criterion here. Only Botswana is the only country in Africa that satisfies all the criteria for European Union exports is Botswana. And even Botswana is questionable. These are Africa's top 10 arms suppliers: America, Russia, Ukraine, China, etc. These are Africa's arms exporters. These are the number of transactions registered in the United Nations Arms Transfers Registry. So it only recognizes the biggest arms deals. And South Africa is by far and away the biggest arms exporter. Some are not shown here, particularly Egypt and Nigeria, because they don't submit returns to that register. Now I'd like to focus on South Africa in particular. And here we have the main profiteer, except that it's a loss maker, is a government-owned arms manufacturer called Danil. During 2011, its sales to other countries were 325 million euros. No, I beg your pardon, not to other countries, its total sales, half of which are for sale to South African Defence Force and the balance to abroad. And it made an operating loss of 31 million euros. It survives through government subsidies and government guarantees of bank loans. It sells unnecessary arms to the South African National Defence Force, and that's the only way it survives. There are numerous other private arms manufacturers in South Africa as well. We have a Conventional Arms Control Act, in terms of which a National Conventional Arms Control Committee is established, and this committee is responsible for the licensing of exports of arms to other countries. In fact, what's happening is that this committee sees its role as a promoter of the arms industry. And it's whether this is by deliberate regulatory capture by the arms industry of the process, or whether it is because the members of the Conventional Arms Control Committee see their mission as promoting industry, South African industry, is not clear. But it certainly fails to apply the criteria for export licenses. It fails to satisfy the transparency requirements that are required in terms of the Act. And in fact, the Act criminalizes disclosure. So it's not surprising that civil servants are reticent about passing on information. And Parliament is failing to hold Danil accountable to hold the Conventional Arms Control Committee accountable for the licenses that it is issuing. I'd like now to talk about the ceasefire campaign's actions with regard to war profiteering in South Africa. The ceasefire was established at the end of when conscription was abolished in South Africa in 1993. Ceasefire was established as a demilitarization organization because we perceived that the history of South Africa was cloaked in militarism, and we needed a new way forward, a way of peace. So we've been drafting complaints to the public protector in terms of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act about the failure of the National Conventional Arms Control Committee with regard to its criteria and its transparency requirements. We've also been investigating constitutional court action regarding the criminalization of disclosure in the Conventional Arms Control Act. We're applying to make presentations to the parliamentary committees concerned regarding the failure of the Conventional Arms Control Committee. We prepared a dossier of arms exports from South Africa last year, and we've updated it this year, and we're wanting Parliament to hear it. We have an open democracy, and the parliamentary committees are willing to hear submissions from civil society about issues of concern to citizens. So we're busy publicising and updating the ceasefire dossier on arms exports. We're also applying in terms of the Promotion of Access to Information Act for copies of documentation of the Conventional Arms Control Committee's procedures for applying the criteria for arms exports, and we're trying to develop a case for tightening the Conventional Arms Control Act itself. We're campaigning for the responsible closure of Danil. Some years ago, the chief executive officer of Danil told Parliament that it would cost 18 billion rands, that's about 1.8 billion euros, to close Danil. But the way he was envisaging its closure was to renege on all outstanding contracts and retrench all staff, which is not what would any sensible person would propose. So what we've perceived is that if government gives Danil no subsidies, if Danil maintains transparency in its dealings abroad, and if export control is properly applied by the Conventional Arms Control Committee, then Danil will cease to exist. It's completely unsustainable. We've demonstrated against particular weapon systems produced by Danil. In this particular case, the Royfalk attack helicopter. Royfalk means a red falcon. An attack helicopter is completely useless for South Africa's conventional needs. And it is said that the only country that could engage South Africa successfully, because of its being at the southern tip of Africa, would be the United States, and the United States would not use conventional weapons to attack South Africa anyway. And here we've been spending 60 billion rands, 6 billion euros, on conventional weapons like frigates and fighter jets and attack helicopters to fight an imaginary war. We have been lobbying the Department of International Relations and Cooperation about South Africa's position in the United Nations process on the Arms Trade Treaty and on the ratification of the ban on cluster bombs. We're also planning submissions on military spending.
5 minutes.
And we're busy working on a submission for a recently established defense review committee. We are going to be proposing that South Africa goes. Our impression is that South Africa is not ready for the Costa Rica option of abolishing the defense force. What we perceive we may be able to achieve is the mothballing of the defense force and just keeping our weapons in storage and enough people to maintain storage and the weapons and the systems. So these are some of the things that ceasefire is doing. South Africa is now a participatory democracy. The voices of the people are heard. But the voice of the peace movement is a still small voice in the corridors of power. The voices of the powerful and the interests of the war profiteers echo more loudly there, but we continue in hope.